The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. We thank you for listening, and today we're talking about your money, your income. Several states are increasing their minimum wage starting January 1st. What will that mean for the workers earning that minimum wage? We want to know, what do you do to get by in today's economy? What does it take to live comfortably?
My name's Denise. I'm calling from Charlestown, Indiana. I think it takes education, hard work, but most importantly, it takes the inner will to succeed.
This is Jean Marie Roth from New Philadelphia, Ohio. We have tried hard work and education, so it must be a trust fund because we are always struggling to make ends meet, mostly due to medical bills.
California and Massachusetts are set to raise their minimum wages to $10 an hour for the first time in 2016. They're among 14 states with plans to increase that hourly minimum wage by January 1st. Some of those increases were voted on last year's, like Alaska's. The dollar increase in the hourly wage there from $8.75 to $9.75 will impact thousands of workers, mainly in the seafood processing industry. But in some states, like Arkansas, workers who get tips are still exempted from the pay hikes. And other states like New Hampshire still don't have a mandated minimum wage at all, meaning it defaults to the federal minimum of $7.25 an hour. These changes mean different things in different parts of the country, but anywhere, is the minimum wage enough to live on? Amy Glassmeyer is professor of economic geography and regional planning at MIT and founder of the Living Wage Calculator. And she says that actually getting by on minimum wage, even after these increases, is nearly impossible.
You have to live in a location where housing is very inexpensive. If you have children, childcare is very inexpensive. And the basic basket of goods you need to live on is capable of being covered by the minimum wage. It is basically not a living wage.
So that's to say then that the minimum wage, even in states where it's substantially higher than the federal minimum of $7.25, there's no such thing as making the minimum wage and not living in poverty. Is that right?
The thing about the minimum wage is we have to look place by place. The cost of living in the United States varies a lot, state by state, county by county. So there are no doubt places in remote locations where there's not much going on, neither changing or evolving through time, where somebody might be able to live on the minimum wage because they've been there a long time and that's built into their cost of living. But in general, $7.25 an hour is not something you can live on.
All right. Well, let's look at a couple of individual states then. There are a dozen states across the country where the minimum wage is going up on January 1st, and some others where it'll increase throughout 2016. Let's look at California first. California is a big, diverse place itself, and San Francisco is a lot more expensive than someplace in the hinterlands. But what do you get for $10 an hour in California?
A person in California that's not living in the heart of most expensive parts of San Francisco or Los Angeles is likely to find $10 an hour is capable of allowing them to rent a room, maybe find a studio apartment and cover their basic costs. But $10 won't cover their basic costs if you look at actual cost of living. So that includes housing, healthcare, childcare, food, clothing, transportation costs. So $10 an hour is certainly a significant minimum wage as a floor, but it's not something that if you actually look at the real costs, that they're covered.
Now, if you go to a place like Nebraska, you have an increase this year from $8 an hour to $9 an hour. Nebraska, I take it, is a place where the overall cost of living is substantially less than a lot of places in California. So $9 in Nebraska gets you what?
$9 in Nebraska is going to get you basically the same basket of goods I described. That is, you'll probably be able to afford a room in a house or a studio apartment, but everything else is variable. And in the case of Nebraska, it's important to remember that the reason that minimum wage is rising is because the cost of living is rising in Nebraska. And it's a part of a set of states that have been impacted by the shale oil boom. And so costs have skyrocketed and rental rates have become unattainable for most people who've been long-term residents.
So in a case like Nebraska or other places where fracking is huge and the economy is booming, that drives up costs, there's a bump in the minimum wage, but the buying power hasn't gone anywhere. In fact, it might have even gone down even with the increase.
That is correct. And more importantly, that there's such a pressure on the basic elements of a lifestyle like housing that landlords are capable of moving the existing renters out and putting new renters in and charging twice as much.
So there are increases in places like Alaska. Arkansas has a 50-cent increase. Michigan has a small increase. I see a place like South Dakota, another place where shale oil and fracking has a huge boom, a 5-cent increase from $8.50 to $8.55. Does this have any meaningful impact on a person making minimum wage in South Dakota, or is this pure indexing or somebody's political move?
A lot of this is probably local indexing. Some of it might be political moves, but I think actually at state levels, state leadership is beginning to realize that it's really hard for ordinary people to get by. And while they can't make the jump to what the real cost of living is, what they're attempting to signal is that they're willing to acknowledge that the cost of living in their state is going up over time.
Now, let's look at the other side of this, because we're all aware of the countervailing argument, which is raising the minimum wage may be a good thing, but it doesn't happen without an impact on businesses that have to pay those wages. Let's look at, for the sake of argument, Rhode Island, if we can. Minimum wage is going up this week, $9 to $9.60. What about the small business that has their wage costs now going to $9.60 in Rhode Island?
So none of these changes are happening in real time. Nobody made a decision yesterday and that wage is going up today. So employers have already been putting into their calculus what this change is going to mean. But most employers also recognize that employees that have worked for them for a long time are actually valuable, and the know-how and the tacit knowledge that they have is something that the business benefits from. So companies will probably start by trying to shore up and tighten other costs that are variable that they actually have more control over and will experience less consequence from.
We're going to see votes, Amy Glassmeyer, in Congress this year. Democrats will be advocating an $11 federal minimum wage. Of course, that's a political imperative as they try to corner the market on income inequality. But away from politics, is there a marker? Is there a dollar amount? If you could set the federal minimum wage yourself with a wand right now, what would it be?
Having a wand would be really great, but I'm a realist. And what I would say is there's a lot of variability in the United States in terms of the cost of living. $11 as a minimum is probably close to what the largest states or the most populous states or the ones that have the most advanced economies, that's going to be a significant adjustment to those wages, but they're in tandem with what the cost of living is actually in those states. But for smaller states and states whose economies have been slower growing and perhaps less diverse, $11 will probably be a big shock.
The minimum wage is edging up in a dozen states across the country on January 1st and in some others as the year goes on. But in most of those places, if not all, the people making the minimum wage still on the edge. Amy Glassmeyer, professor of economic geography and regional planning at MIT and founder of the Living Wage Calculator. Thank you so much, professor.
You're welcome.
This is Joel from Pacheco, California. In order to live comfortably in the United States, you have to start out as early as possible, debt-free as possible. If you don't have the financial support early on, you're going to be saddled with debt well into adulthood. And as a result, you'll sacrifice savings for retirement, putting off buying a home, or even relocating to improve your situation.
Well, as we heard a few moments ago, in most places around the country and for most people, getting by, much less getting ahead, is nearly impossible on the minimum wage. Shahara Zalem is 19 years old. She works in a McDonald's in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's making $9.50 an hour, and as of Friday, New Year's Day, she's eligible for a raise. That's because Massachusetts is raising its minimum wage to $10 an hour. She's also involved with Fight for 15, an organization that's fought for over a year to raise the minimum wage around the country. Shahara, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So describe your expenses. Describe what going from $9.50 to $10 an hour will do for you. A big increase?
I definitely appreciate it because it'll definitely help me in a small way, even if it's just like whether or not I get to buy like more food at the end of the month. I don't think that making $10 an hour will impact my life as much as I needed to. Because $9.50 an hour is a struggle. It's a lot of the time it pushes me against a wall where I have to decide which bills I'm going to pay first. And it requires like a lot of prioritizing whether I'm going to pay the electricity or the rent first.
Now, the $9.50 you make now at your job at McDonald's, are you supporting just yourself?
I actually have partial custody of my younger brother and sister.
So what does that mean in terms of your expenses?
I have to pay for my apartment as well as three other cell phone lines, as well as food for not just myself, but for my younger brother and sister, for the rest of my family as well.
Okay, and your typical work week, are you working 40 hours or a lot more than that?
Actually, I am not, because my boss was cutting hours due to him hiring more people.
So at the end of the week, let's say even at $10 an hour with the increase you're getting, what are you taking home?
Maybe an extra like $10, $15.
How far does that really go at the end of the week or at the end of the month when you look at it?
It doesn't go far. It's an extra like 50 cents an hour to my check. And even though it gives me a little bit more, it's not the boost that I need. I need 15 to be able to support myself and my family.
So describe most of your coworkers there. People envision, I think, when you're working at McDonald's, it's usually a first job. You're 16. Mom and dad pay for most things. So making $9.50 or $10 is just fine because you don't have a whole lot of expenses. Is that the situation of most people you know?
No, I actually, a lot of my coworkers are in a similar boat. I know single mothers. I know like a lot of college students that are trying to like pay their way through school. I know a lot of like high school students that are just recently graduating, trying to afford going to school.
And can I ask what else you're doing, if anything, to get a better job? Is there any prospect for a higher paying job? Are you going to school?
I actually can't, because I have to stay home to take care of my younger brother and sister.
So you have partial custody of them. You have to take care of them and work where you can.
Exactly. I'm taking what I can get.
Well, good luck to you, Shahara.
Thank you.
Shahara Zalim is a 19-year-old worker at McDonald's in Cambridge, Massachusetts. In addition to supporting herself, she also supports her young siblings. With the new year, her minimum wage salary increases by 50 cents.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, which has funded research that led to blood cancer treatments such as chemotherapy and stem cell transplants, and more recently, targeted therapies and immunotherapies to save thousands of lives. More at lls.org. TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
The other end of the income scale, the extreme other end, the 0.01% of Americans who've had great success in business or investing or that trust fund inheritance. Many of them are also remaking the tax system in their own interest to save millions of dollars every year. It's the subject of a new investigation by Noam Scheiber, labor and workplace reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And Noam joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Let's start with the bottom line, Noam. How has the effective tax rate changed for the ultra wealthy over the last 30 years? What are they paying?
Yeah, well, if you look at the top 400 income earners in the country, which the IRS actually tracks and publishes data on their average tax rate, it was in the mid to upper 20s in the early 1990s, then dropped 10 years later to the low 20s. And in 2012, the last year for which we have data, it was under 17%. And by comparison, if you look at a taxpayer making about $100,000 a year in that same year, and you added in payroll taxes for both, they would be roughly equivalent. They would both pay roughly the same average tax rate.
Now, that's not, as I understand it, because the tax law has changed to say 400 wealthiest families, you get to pay less now for the most part. It's mostly because of a lot of creative and expensive navigation and mining of the tax code. Is that right?
Yeah, it's really two things. It's policy, and in particular, two big changes. In the late 90s, Bill Clinton signed legislation that lowered the capital gains tax rate, and then George W. Bush did that again in the early 2000s. And much of the income that the ultra wealthy earn is in the form of capital gains. So that was a huge tax cut for the ultra wealthy. But that's only part of the story. The other story is what you allude to, which is kind of gaming the system. And what the wealthy and their tax advisors and estate planners spend a lot of time and resources doing is essentially converting a lot of other types of income that would be taxed at a much higher rate into that low capital gains rate. So the change in policy is both helpful to them in itself because they do have a lot of capital gains, and it's also the basis for a enormous amount of tax schemery. and this conversion idea is very much at the center of it, and they are very much expert in exploiting that.
All right, so let's be clear. The capital gains rate that you describe is just a much lower tax rate, money that you make on investments, than normal income, the income tax that we all paid, even if it says on paper that the ultra wealthy pay, I don't know what it is, 45% rate or a 39% rate, that capital gains rate is much, much lower. And that's why you want to get there if you have that kind of money. Now, you've reported on a bunch of different ways, methods, you might call them expensive tricks, I suppose, that some of these ultra wealthy families are using to get to that lower rate. One is called the family office. This isn't like setting up a home office with a printer and a laptop computer. It's something different.
It is not. That's right. And actually, the family office is less the strategy than the means of planning the strategy. So a family office is essentially the personal wealth management arm of a very, very rich family. You have contained within that institution people who manage your investments, people who manage your philanthropic contributions, and people who manage your tax liabilities. It's very helpful to have all these things intersect in one office because they all have implications for one another. So if you're managing the investments, it's a good idea to think about the tax implications of those investments. And just to give one example that we use in the piece, if you are investing in a hedge fund and you invest directly in that hedge fund, you are going to have a lot of gains that are going to be taxed at the ordinary income rate, 43.4% after the Affordable Care Act. So it's going to be taxed at around 40% if you invest directly in a hedge fund. However, if you invest that money in an insurance company based in Bermuda, and that insurance company that invests in the hedge fund, you roughly cut in half your tax rate on those gains. So if you're a family office executive and you're trying to plan the most tax-efficient investment strategy, it is very helpful for you to know that such loopholes exist, and that's exactly what goes on in these offices.
So I got to get myself a reinsurance company in Bermuda. That's all I have to do, right?
That's exactly what you need.
Right. So, I mean, but I'm making a joke, but the point here is not that these activities are necessarily illegal. It's that they're so arcane and so expensive to achieve and find out that nobody but these families can afford the phalanx of lawyers and specialists to do it.
That's exactly right. Yes, many of them are very much in plain view. They're absolutely unassailable legally. They just require two things: incredibly sophisticated legal and estate planning advice to suss them out in the first place, and then a lot of money. They're like a very large transaction cost. So unless you have hundreds of millions of dollars, it doesn't make sense for you to spend a few million dollars setting up a transaction like this. On the other hand, if you do have hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, then the couple million dollars it takes to set it up is really, you know, it's just the cost of business.
And also the cost of business to fight and negotiate with the IRS if they turn a sideways eye at some of these activities. What is the IRS doing with some of these family offices and Bermuda partnerships? Do they look askance at it? And what happens when you turn your phalanx of lawyers on them?
Yes. So certainly in the last 5-6 years, the IRS has felt that it's very important to scrutinize high net worth individuals. In 2009, they began a special task force to aggressively scrutinize the tax returns of taxpayers with over $10 million a year in earnings. And, you know, that program has produced something. You know, it's they've managed to claw back some revenue that otherwise would have gone either unreported or unpaid to the government. But funding shortages have just really undermined these efforts. The IRS, in real dollar terms, the IRS budget has fallen over $2.5 billion in the past 5 years. It's about 20%. And these efforts to scrutinize the tax returns of the ultra wealthy are just so expensive and so resource intensive. I mean, there are just teams of accountants and lawyers and forensic, you know, investigators that have to be assigned to these teams and unless to these tax returns. And unless you have the full complement of personnel, it's almost impossible. I mean, it's almost impossible to suss it out, even if you do have the full complement of personnel. But if you don't, it's utterly hopeless.
All right, Noam Chaibari, let's talk about Congress, because only Congress can change these rules. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, and others have been promising to try for some kind of tax reform, some reform of the tax code. And it could take many different forms. They talk about closing loopholes and flattening out the tax rate. We hear that all the time. But set the scene. How big is the army of lawyers and lobbyists that swoops in around the committee room to preserve these types of maneuvers if that negotiation starts?
It's enormous. Just if you just look at, you know, the leading hedge fund industry group and the leading private equity fund industry group, they both spend several $1 million a year in lobbying. And that's, you know, I mean, that's just one corner of this. The biggest loophole of all, as we said at the outset, is really the capital gains preference, taxing capital gains at a substantially lower rate. It both has a direct effect in lowering the rate. And it's just the foundation for all these other loopholes. And unless they're going to get, you know, kind of focus on that, which I think is unlikely, we're really tinkering at the margins.
A wide, wide range of loopholes, rabbit holes, and tricks that the ultra-wealthy use to lower their taxes. It's not illegal, but only they can afford the key. Noam Chaibari, labor and workplace reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And lots of you are talking about what it takes to live comfortably in America today. From Anoka, Minnesota, money and connections can give someone a bigger step up than hard work will ever pay out. Education is the great equalizer for young people, with one big caveat: as long as it doesn't saddle them with debt.
My name is Angelina, and I'm calling from Ashland, Oregon. I think to live comfortably in the United States, it takes family support, not necessarily financial, but emotional support and the giving of time.
Hi, this is Carl Marking from Coatesville, Pennsylvania. I think it takes hard work, drive, luck, patience, and a reasonable definition of comfortably.
From Chicago, Illinois, what does it take to make it a miracle? The American dream is a myth, and economists worldwide produce evidence to support that throughout the 1900s to the present. Very few percentile of Americans have found upward mobility through the classes. We're just as class segregated as India. If you're born into poverty here, a 90% chance you'll stay there. How is that achieving the American dream? And middle class, how can you support a family of three on $30,000 and still have a car and a college education for your child and a home? You can't.
I'm Kaylee from Buffalo, New York. I think that it takes an education. Knowing the way that the system works with and against you is key. And using that knowledge to acquire what you need to be comfortable with based on what comfortable means to you.
Hi, this is Chris Page from Winooski, Vermont. And to live comfortably in the United States, it takes education with a plan and then hard work from then on. The current model of throwing high school students into college with all of those doors wide open can be extremely damaging in that it has left a lot of young people with dead-end degrees. It's important to have some kind of vision before spending $100,000 or more on what may only amount to a wall decoration.
And from Fort Washington, Pennsylvania, how to make it to be born a white male into a wealthy family. We always want to hear from you. Give us your take at 8778-MYTAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by scientists that has been used by 70 million people worldwide, with training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
All this week, we've been looking at the new debates around mobile devices, privacy, and surveillance. We're calling it lockup, encryption, and the law. On Monday, we spoke to Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance. He says that law enforcement is blind to important evidence on locked devices and that they need new laws to guarantee access with a warrant. We also heard from Julian Sanchez of the Cato Institute saying that weakening encryption only creates opportunities for criminals and terrorists and that there are huge downsides to giving law enforcement the key. Today, we look at the large and growing range of technology turning up in law enforcement agencies, many of them developed for the military and intelligence agencies. It's dozens and dozens of devices used to intercept calls, read text messages, and determine locations of phones. A previously undisclosed catalog of the devices was published in The Intercept this month. They range from $5,500 to upwards of $100,000 with a wide range of capabilities. We caught up with Christopher Segoyan. He's principal technologist at the American Civil Liberties Union. He was at the annual Chaos Communications Congress in Germany. He says the devices and their sweeping surveillance capabilities could spread to state and local law enforcement within the next few years.
So these devices, which are still used by the Air Force and the intelligence community in war zones, are very sophisticated and in fact can collect a significant amount of information from cell phones. These devices not only identify all phones that are in an area, but in some cases can intercept cell phone calls, can intercept text messages, and even be used to deliver surveillance software to essentially to hack into a cell phone. There's no evidence thus far to suggest that these more sophisticated capabilities are available to law enforcement, to state or local police. So we believe that the police only have the ability to identify nearby phones, but certainly the intelligence community and the military have access to the most sophisticated features built into these devices.
Can you describe how a Stingray works? We've seen in other news reports that there are devices that basically fool a phone into thinking it's talking to a cell phone tower, but it's not. It's talking to the cops. Is that how it works?
Yeah, and you know, the Stingray is the name brand of one of the products. Think of the Stingray as the Coca-Cola. The Stingray and that family of technology, they essentially function by impersonating a legitimate cell phone tower. One way of thinking about this, if you've ever played the game Marco Polo, the Stingray shouts out Marco, and every cell phone in the vicinity that uses the phone company that's being impersonated shouts back Polo. The devices, in fact, respond with the unique serial number that each phone has, and by listening, can figure out where the phones are shouting their Polo from.
Now, is there evidence that these devices have been used illegally domestically, basically without a warrant?
Well, the answer is complicated because, you know, the Stingray, it's not so much a device as a platform. And what that means is the Harris Corporation, which makes the Stingray, will sell this base system to law enforcement, and then they have to pay for additional features. They have to pay for a feature that impersonates the networks used by Sprint and Verizon. And then there's a different module that impersonates the networks used by AT&T and T-Mobile. They have to pay for a module that can identify 4G devices, newer phones. We don't believe the Harris Corporation has sold the features that allow state or locals to intercept calls or text messages. And so the question is, if state and locals are just using these devices to identify all phones in the area, which involves sending probing signals into the homes, into the living rooms, into the cars, the purses, and the pockets of hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of people nearby, does that require a warrant? And there are some judges who have said, yes, that does require a warrant. But state and local law enforcement agencies around the country still continue to use these devices without warrants. And the fact is that most judges don't really know what they're being asked to authorize. They don't know how these devices work. And so most judges are approving these lesser court orders, these non-warrants, and giving local police permission to actually engage in Stingray-based surveillance.
Apple and Google responded to the Edward Snowden revelations by very famously and publicly announcing that their products would be locked, encrypted without a key, so that they couldn't be searched. And that was a premium for customers who didn't want to be surveilled. Is there going to be market pressure now or consumer pressure on cell phone carriers, if possible, to retrofit their networks so that they can't be impersonated in this way? Is that technically feasible? And is Sprint, Verizon, T-Mobile going to want to guarantee to their customers that they can't be swept up if the cops are looking for somebody else?
So the answer to your question is actually a lot more complex than it seems. The first thing is that although Google did announce last year that they would be encrypting Android phones by default, the company subsequently backed down from that because the way that Google uses encryption, it actually slows down the performance of many of the devices. And the companies that make Android phones, like Motorola and Samsung, are not too keen on releasing new phones that are slower than last year's model. And so while there has been a lot of media coverage about this encryption topic, most phones that consumers buy today still are not encrypted. It would be very easy for the phone companies to deliver products to consumers that are more secure. Perhaps not that can protect consumers from the tracking by Stingrays, but certainly that could protect consumers from wiretaps and interception of their text messages. And we've not seen any indication that the carriers wish to either compete on privacy or make it easier for their customers to protect their privacy.
Christopher Segoyan, before we let you go, was there anything on this exhaustive catalog, this list that The Intercept published in terms of the devices available that surprised you?
I think that the high cost of these devices is surprising. I mean, obviously, state and local agencies are not going to spend, you know, $2 million for a device, and it's, of course, no secret that the military pays top dollar. So the cost of this technology was surprising, but also the variety. In fact, it's not just, you know, Coke and Pepsi who are selling surveillance products. You know, the Harris and Boeing, there are, in fact, 10, 20 other companies who also have similar products. This is, in fact, quite a competitive market filled with companies who are eager to sell highly sophisticated surveillance devices. And of course, you know, these defense contractors are not content to merely sell to the military. Eventually, they are looking for other markets, whether that is foreign sales to our allies or to state and local agencies. But I suspect it's only a matter of time before state and locals acquire the ability to intercept calls or the ability to acquire text messages, and then ultimately the ability to infect cell phones with malware, to hack into phones. Just because this is only available to the military or the intelligence community now doesn't mean that they will continue to be exclusive in 5 years or 10 years.
Christopher Segoin, thank you.
Thank you.
Christopher Segoin is principal technologist at the ACLU. Today marks the fifth day of Kwanzaa, the week-long cultural celebration by African Americans was created at the height of the Black nationalist movement in 1965 by a graduate student named Malana Karenga. Karenga was disturbed by social unrest and decided it was important for African Americans to have an official occasion to reaffirm their cultural heritage.
In my family, we celebrate Kwanzaa. Every night, we light a candle on the Kinara. That's a candle holder with a candle for each of the 7 nights of Kwanzaa.
That's the Sesame Street treatment for Kwanzaa there. Each of the holiday 7 days focuses on a different principle, like umoja or unity. There's Imani, which is faith, Nia, purpose, and Kumba, creativity, to name a few. 50 years after its creation, Kwanzaa is still celebrated, but like any other holiday, still gets made fun of.
And the last and most important forgotten Kwanzaa principle is Annie is Uoki. It is the practice of being struck by a smooth criminal. Annie is Uoki.
That was NPR's Gene Demby with Heben Nagatu and Tracy Clayton, hosts of the podcast Another Round, at their Kwanzaa Spectacular, hosted at the Green Space here at WNYC earlier this month, having a little bit of fun with the 7 principles of Kwanzaa. Christina Greer is associate professor of political science at Fordham University in New York, where she specializes in urban politics and public opinion. She's author of the book Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. She told me that while not all African Americans today may feel a real connection with Kwanzaa, the holiday, those key principles can still open up the door for much needed reflection on what it means to be Black in America today.
As someone who does not celebrate Kwanzaa, I can still appreciate the 7 principles in a larger context, in the sense that if we're thinking about self-determination, purpose, fiscal and community empowerment, these are all things that not just the African-American community can really use and utilize in their daily lives, but I think a large percentage of Americans can do that as well.
There has been some criticism that I've heard, maybe not of Kwanzaa directly, but of sort of mainstream Black spiritualism, that it is missing the struggle of today, that a lot of people, especially activists, want to see language and action that is much more direct than what is in here. It's fine to say unity and self-determination. How about direct action? How about political revolution? How about getting in the street? Things that aren't quite as inclusive as some of these Kwanzaa principles and much more confrontational.
Well, I would say a few things. One, we're at a moment where it's very complicated and difficult to define the Black community, right? So what I wrote about in Black Ethnics is that we have such a wide array of not just geographic diversity, but now ethnic diversity, economic diversity. So when we say the Black community, that in and of itself can be 17 different opinions. Two, this isn't a religious holiday. It's just like 7 days of reflection, if you will. So if we're thinking about Kwanzaa in that realm, these are just guiding principles that I think people today who really want more policy prescriptions, right? And they don't necessarily have to be mutually exclusive. We can have protest politics as well as electoral politics, right? I mean, I think there's a need for both. I think that we do need people to march in the streets and demand things in a confrontational space. I also think that we need to go to the ballot and vote people in and out of office as we see fit. So if we're thinking about this concept of unity, well, we can have diversity and unity as well.
Right. And when a holiday comes around and people pay attention to it as an African-American holiday, there's a tendency, maybe a forgivable one, to say that it represents that community as a whole.
Right. But, you know, in some ways it's like, well, if we're thinking about this as a Black American holiday, maybe some Caribbeans or Africans will identify with it, right? Then they say, well, you know, these are sort of community principles that I subscribe to. Why not, right? Others, including many Black Americans across the country, see this as this is a made-up holiday, just like St. Patrick's Day is a made-up holiday, just like Christopher Columbus Day is a made-up holiday.
Yeah, let me stop you there, because I want to – can we address this eye-rolling criticism that Kwanzaa is a made-up holiday all the time? Can you name a holiday that's not made up?
Most holidays are made up.
Not most. Not right. Most. All holidays are made up. Even if the underlying story is true to you, right, from the Bible or wherever.
Right.
Holidays are contrivance. They're right. All made up.
Well, I think that's just another way to sort of, you know, belittle what some people view as a really special, important time for them. But I think it's also, you know, this is also not a holiday that every Black American partakes in. My parents taught me all of the things that Kwanzaa represents, but they never framed it as Kwanzaa. We never celebrated Kwanzaa. Did they teach me about unity? Yes. Did they teach me about creativity? Absolutely. Did they teach me about, you know, supporting and loving people who look like me and people who are from my community, small and large, domestically, internationally, you know, having sort of a pride in being Black American, having a pride in being part of a larger African diaspora? Absolutely. Was it ever couched in the language of Kwanzaa? Never.
Christina Greer, it's one thing to have conversations with your kids over candles or not about unity and purpose and faith and things like that. You can't speak for all families out there, I know that, but what do you imagine in a lot of families in 2015 or 2016 now? The conversation with kids is like, is it about purpose and unity, or is it for a lot of people about why did Laquan McDonald get shot or how do I stay safe? We've had a lot of guests on this show having conversations with their kids about how to stay safe.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully those two things don't necessarily have to be mutually exclusive. I think that there are a lot of families, hopefully white families, are also having conversations with their kids about this as well, right? Because that's the only way things really are going to change. On the one hand, I think a lot of Black families are trying to explain to their children about Tamir Rice and Trayvon Martin and Laquan McDonald and Sandra Bland and all these other stories that, you know, they're seeing on the internet or on their phones. They're hearing about it in school. So it's forcing a lot of parents to have, in some ways, a premature conversation that maybe they were planning on having. Every Black parent has to have that conversation with their child about public safety and the police and the power of the police. But then that doesn't necessarily mean that that doesn't go hand in hand with other principles, right, of community uplift and perseverance and determination and purpose and unity. They're not separate, but we also have to look at the reality of the situation in the mid-teens of the 21st century and realize that we're at a moment, in some ways we feel like we're in the middle of this tornado. Maybe that speaks to why certain individuals or certain families are thinking about Kwanzaa in a different way this year. And just because if you have these principles that you can sort of give yourself for strength or give your children for a little bit of guidance and clarity in the midst of what is a very, very harsh reality for a specific group of people, maybe those two in conjunction help the holiday season or the cultural season or this 7-day stretch of reflection. Maybe it helps give it a little more focus and foundation. I'm not lighting candles, but I do think that there are enough people who really want to think about making themselves and their communities better that I'm willing to respect that.
If not candles and named days, principles that endure clearly. Christina Greer, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University, author of Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A reminder that there's always more over at the website at thetakeaway.org. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding cancer research across the continuum, from basic research through clinical trials to advanced therapies that save thousands of lives. More information is available at lls.org.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.